You're listening to SurgeCast, a podcast made specifically for busy general surgery residents. Okay, welcome everyone. We are now in the section of esophagus. This is the first section in the alimentary tract, so we're going to basically, over the next several sections, go through the esophagus, then the stomach, small intestine, large intestine, and then the anorectal section as well. So just to give you kind of an overview of where we're going to go, we're going to start first with this lecture on motility disorders, and then we'll move into GERD, hiatal hernias, esophageal perforation, esophageal diverticulum, and finally, cancer. So this first lecture we're going to get into here is on esophageal motility disorders, and we'll also kind of cover esophagomyotomy as well. So just some basic principles. With any of these disorders, I want you to pay attention to at least three different things. And one is a basal LES pressure. The second is whether or not the LES is relaxing. And number three is whether or not the esophagus is adequately peristalsing. So those are all findings that you'll find on manometry. And remember, it's important to differentiate oropharyngeal dysphagia from esophageal dysphagia. Oropharyngeal dysphagia in general is a difficulty when someone's initiating a swallow, while esophageal dysphagia causes symptoms after that swallow is initiated. In general, obstructive lesions and inflammatory conditions are more common than motility disorders, and obstructive lesions typically cause greater symptoms with solids than with liquids, while folks who have motility disorders can have symptoms with both solids and liquids. Again, generally speaking, endoscopy is the first step in diagnosing anything that has to do with dysphagia, and then it's usually followed by high-resolution manometry. You also want to think about getting a barium esophagram in these folks, because that can help identify obstructive lesions or achalasia, but it's not very, very sensitive in motility disorders. In folks who have an esophageal motility disorder, you also want to consider causes of esophageal dysmotility, such as scleroderma, diabetes, and alcohol abuse. And we're not going to go too terribly in-depth into those, but just remember that scleroderma causes a fibrous replacement of that esophageal smooth muscle, which leads to low LES pressure and aperistalsis, and it usually presents with massive reflux and with strictures, and the treatment's usually with the PPI. So we're going to basically cover three big esophageal dysmotility disorders today. The first one is going to be diffuse esophageal spasm, then we'll get into nutcracker esophagus, and finally into achalasia. So Catherine, why don't you start with DES?
So DES, or diffuse esophageal spasm. So the epidemiology of this, it's very uncommon. It's actually the cause of less than 10% of all esophageal motility disorders, and it's affecting less than one in every 100,000 people a year. But just because it's uncommon doesn't mean it's not on the upside all the time. The pathophysiology of this is really unclear. There's some thought it might be due to some uncoordinated neuronal signaling. But patients who have this are going to present with kind of that typical presentation for motility disorders, with atypical or non-cardiac chest pain and dysphagia. And so to differentiate this from things we're going to talk about in a second, nutcracker esophagus or achalasia, you're really going to rely on esophageal manometry and barium swallow. So the manometry is the gold standard for the diagnosis of DES, and what you're going to see is a normal LES pressure and a normal ability of the LES to relax. But the peristalsis is what's different here. So you see early contraction in the distal esophagus, and it's what's called uncoordinated peristalsis. Sometimes these patients can have this corkscrew appearance on a barium swallow. It's a nonspecific finding, but that's definitely one of those buzzwords that can come up on a test question. The management of this is generally non-operative. So medical management, things like nitrate, sildenafil, calcium channel blockers, and TCAs, any of those things can be used to help relieve the non-cardiac chest pain. And then oftentimes these patients need to be treated with PPIs just because they frequently have a co-occurrence of GERD. Operative management is an option, but very rarely. So endoscopic therapy with Botox or pneumatic dilation can be used, but really has limited benefit. And in extraordinary cases, you can think about a long myotomy for really refractory DES. But this can be associated with significant morbidity. So realistically, that's not something that you're really going to pick on a test question, and you're only going to offer it to a very select subset of patients.
Perfect. So I'll move on then to nutcracker esophagus. So this is, again, a very rare cause of esophageal dysmotility, and the usual patient is someone in their sixth or seventh decade of life. Again, not 100% sure exactly how this happens, but some folks have postulated that it might be due to alterations in neurotransmitter signaling or nitric oxide signaling. Very much like DES, these folks will present with atypical or non-cardiac chest pain and or dysphagia. And the esophageal manometry, again, is going to be the key in differentiating these two disease processes from each other on a test, because the rest of it is pretty similar. So when you look at that basal LES pressure, that will be normal. The LES itself will have normal relaxation, and the peristalsis will be coordinated. So they might say these are coordinated high amplitude esophageal contractions on a test. In terms of the non-operative and operative management, very similar again here to diffuse esophageal spasm. So the medical management is usually with calcium channel blockers such as diltiazem. They've been shown to lower that distal peristaltic pressure and can also reduce chest pain. And again, you want to think about things like nitrates, sildenafil, TCAs, and PPIs. Similar to DES, also endoscopic therapy has been utilized, but it's not very effective. So moving into kind of the most common one that we see, that would be achalasia. Catherine, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
So achalasia is both the most common one that is going to come up in patients, but additionally, the most common one that comes up on the test. And I think every year I've had an achalasia question on the app site. So even if you ignore the rest of this part of this podcast, you definitely want to listen to the achalasia part here. So the epidemiology of this, it's about 1.6 per 100,000 individuals, and there's a really wide age range of people that can pop up with this, anything from people in their 20s to people in their 60s. The pathophysiology of this, unlike the other two types, is fairly well described. It's due to a loss of ganglion cells and fibrosis of the myenteric nerves. It's believed to be due to autoimmune-mediated destruction, but that's still kind of an investigational thing. These patients are going to present with progressive chest pain, odynephagia, dysphagia, regurgitation, and in really severe cases, these patients can come in with pretty significant weight loss. For the diagnosis of this, patients who get an EGD can have a dilated esophagus with retained food, and can actually be quite difficult to pass the scope through the LES. The manometry is the gold standard for diagnosis, and to hit those points that you really want to think about, they have an increased LES pressure, a decreased LES relaxation, and then absent or impaired esophageal peristalsis. The barium swallow has the pathognomonic bird's beak appearance, which is basically a sharp tapering of barium trying to pass through that tightened lower esophageal sphincter. You can also have a very dilated esophagus seen on these barium swallows for patients with achalasia. First step for some patients can be non-operative management. So pharmacologic, you want to think about calcium channel blockers or long-acting nitrates can reduce the LES pressure. That's going to lead to temporary relief, but it really doesn't improve LES relaxation or peristalsis due to the short duration, and there's really incomplete symptom relief with that. Botox injection is an option. You want to inject that into all four quadrants of the LES. If you do that, unfortunately, it's going to lead to short-term response, symptomatic reduction in about 75% of patients. But there's a lot of controversy around this because it really can lead to submucosal scarring, which impacts the dissection of the mucosal plane and can really increase your risk of esophageal mucosal injury. So Botox injection is really reserved for patients who are not going to be undergoing operative treatment and are never really going to become operative candidates. The other option is pneumatic dilatation, and that's the most effective non-surgical treatment for the palliation of dysphagia. And graded dilation can produce local rupture of LES fibers, meaning it's a little bit more durable than Botox. Unfortunately, it does carry kind of a 4-7% risk of esophageal perforation, and that's something that we're going to talk about more extensively in another lecture.
Okay, so I'll kind of get into the operative management then. The first thing I'll go over is a poem, and then I'll talk about kind of the traditional myotomy. So a poem, I think you may see this pop up on a test now, and it might be the right answer, so I think it's worth discussing. A poem is essentially, stands for peroral endoscopic myotomy. And so what that means is instead of the traditional open approach, we do this endoscopically. You take your scope down to the mid-esophageal level, around 13 centimeters from the gastroesophageal junction, and you inject a little bit of saline in the submucosal layer. Then you actually take your scope and introduce it through that submucosal layer and make an incision on the mucosal surface itself. You create a submucosal tunnel and extend that onto the stomach. And then finally, you close the site of entry with a hemostatic clip or fibrin glue. Again, this is becoming more and more widespread, and so it's certainly something to be familiar with, although not 100% sure if it'll pop up on a test. And so you definitely also have to be familiar with kind of the traditional Heller myotomy, which can be done so either via the transthoracic approach or the transabdominal approach. It can be done both open and laparoscopically. So I'll go over the kind of laparoscopic transabdominal approach. First things first, place your patient in reverse Trendelenburg. Start your dissection with a division of the phrenoesophageal membrane and the gastrophrenic ligaments. That dissection will then extend posteriorly to the decussation of the crura and continue that until the left and right crura are completely free and the esophagus can be fully mobilized. You want to have at least 4 to 5 centimeters below the hiatus without tension. If you need a little bit more length, you can always divide your short gastric vessels or any of the omental attachments. And then the anterior esophageal fat pad can be removed so that you can expose the gastroesophageal junction. Now, this step is critical right here. This is something that I've seen a lot on exams as well. The extent of your myotomy is going to be about 1 to 2 centimeters above the GEJ and then extended 5 centimeters in a cephalad direction and 2 centimeters caudally onto the stomach. Finally, you pass a 48 to 52 French bougie. And at that time, you start thinking about doing your fundoplication. And so that can either be a full Nissen, that's a 360-degree wrap, or a partial toupee, which is a posterior or door anterior wrap. We'll talk a lot about those when we kind of get into our GERD section. But for now, just remember that any partial fundoplication is generally preferred if a patient has any dysmotility disorders. Because obviously you don't want to kind of compound the dysmotility by giving them a full wrap. So before we get into the high points, we're just going to kind of summarize the things that we've said about the manometric findings in these different disease processes, because this really is what can be tested. So first, I guess we'll do diffuse esophageal spasm. So the basal LES pressure in diffuse esophageal spasm is normal. The LES has normal relaxation, and there is uncoordinated high-amplitude contractions or peristalsis. And that's how it's going to be described on a test. Nutcracker esophagus has a normal basal LES pressure, normal LES relaxation, so far exactly the same as DES, but the differentiating factor is going to be that there are coordinated peristaltic contractions. And again, that's exactly how it's going to be described on a test. Next would be achalasia, in which there is a increased basal LES pressure and abnormal relaxation of the LES, and the peristalsis will be either absent or hypotonic. You might see this described again as incomplete LES relaxation with impaired or absent peristalsis, and those two findings are going to be key to help you kind of key in on the fact that it is achalasia that they're describing. And finally, something we didn't go over too much, which is the isolated hypertensive LES. And the name again tells you exactly what it is. So it's a basal LES pressure that is above normal, normal LES relaxation, and normal peristalsis. So, okay, why don't we get into some of the high points here. Number one, Catherine, what are the steps for working up any esophageal dysmotility disorder?
Basically, any esophageal dysmotility disorder, number one, you need an EGD. Next, you need manometry, and then a barium swallow. Those things are basically going to help you diagnose any dysmotility disorder you need.
Okay. Number two, so what is DES and how do you treat it?
So DES is basically uncoordinated peristalsis, but remember it has normal LES pressure and relaxation, and it's best treated non-operatively. You want to think about medical management with something like calcium channel blocker and then a PPI for treatment of the co-occurring GERD.
Okay, so can you compare and contrast that with nutcracker esophagus and how you treat nutcracker esophagus?
So nutcracker esophagus is instead a high amplitude peristaltic contraction. But remember, that's a coordinated contraction, whereas DES is really just uncoordinated. Like DES, nutcracker esophagus has a normal LES pressure, but you want to treat that again the same way. Think about medical management first. Calcium channel blockers and PPIs are going to help those patients the most. Surgery is really a last option.
Okay. And what causes achalasia, and what are the kind of characteristic manometric findings for achalasia?
So achalasia is due to autoimmune destruction of neuronal ganglion cells that leads to increased LES pressure, poor LES relaxation, and then absent or weak peristalsis.
Okay. And finally, what are the surgical and non-surgical treatment options we have available for achalasia?
So achalasia can be treated with pneumatic dilation for non-surgical candidates, endoscopic means, which is the POEM procedure, or surgical options, which is the myotomy or Heller myotomy. And remember, when you're thinking about that myotomy, one of the highest yield points is that you want to create that myotomy, and then it's going to be extended 5 centimeters cephalad and 2 centimeters caudally onto the stomach.
Awesome. I think that's going to bring us to the end of this lecture. We'll see you next time as we continue on in the esophagus section.
You can find SurgeCast on Spotify or iTunes. Make sure you follow us on Instagram or Twitter @SurgeCastPodcast or find us at SurgeCastPodcast.com.